One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Ancient Office Hours by the Ozymandias Project. Trireme Transit is now boarding for all new and returning passengers. Now departing, present ponderings. Next stop is Ancient Office Hours at a library lost in the sands of time.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 87 of Ancient Office Hours. This week, I sat down with Dr. Chelsea Gardner, a professor of classical archaeology at Acadia University. Her research is centered around archaeological exploration in southern Greece, and her fieldwork is in the Mani Peninsula, just south of ancient Sparta. There, she is the co-director of the Cartography Project, a digital humanities mapping project that aims to analyze and recreate the routes of early modern travelers, as well as the new Southern Mani Archaeological Project. She is also one of the founders of Peopling the Past, which produces free audio, video, and blog resources for learning about real people who lived in the ancient Mediterranean world. She also hosts the Peopling the Past podcast. In this episode, we discuss her path from psychology to pedestrian survey in Greece, her work with the Peopling the Past podcast, and how she and her Peopling the Past colleagues handle modern reception via a multitude of digital platforms. I hope you enjoy this episode. And if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify.
Great. Thanks for joining me this morning. Pretty exciting. So I want to just ask you a really, hopefully, easy question. And that's, how did you, or when did you discover your passion for, like, ancient history?
So I should have known this was coming. My, like, classic narrative that I tell people is I was not, like, so many of my very eager students in that I didn't really grow up with, you know, knowing Greek mythology or being super interested in ancient Egypt. I didn't really know that archaeology was a thing that people could do. And like so many students, I entered my undergrad. I went to McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario for my undergrad. I entered as a psych major. Right? As one does. And I am really bad at calculus. So I failed calculus in my first year as an undergrad and had to retake it the next year, which meant I couldn't officially be a second year psych major until I'd passed all of these requirements. And so I had a bunch of other electives to take. And I took Introduction to World Archaeology, which was a full year course, and Introduction to World Religions, which was a full year course. And by the end of the year, I had switched out of psychology and was double majoring in classics and religious studies. So that's how I came to it. It was really just you can do this. And I fell in love with archaeology and haven't looked back.
Well, that's great. You know, I mean, anytime we can steal someone away from the like STEMy field,
totally.
I'm just like,
especially psychology. They have enough majors.
Well, because that's like, right, there's that perception that like, if you major in psych, then you can just be private practicing therapist where you sit in an office all day. And then you just see 100%. People and, you know, sit sort of cross-legged with a notepad and go, how do you feel about that all day? And just make money, tons of money.
That's right. Well, and almost nobody ends up being like a clinical psychologist. And, you know, most people get an undergraduate degree and then they go on to find something usually not at all related to your undergrad. Obviously, that's not the case for the people that you speak to, but I tell a lot of a lot of my students who don't necessarily want to go on to grad school or don't necessarily want to go on to be like professionals in this field, but who love classics or love archaeology, you might as well really enjoy what you're doing for these 4 years, stand out because it's such an unusual major and get some really good grades because you love what you're doing instead of like trying to slog through something that you think looks good on paper. Yeah. So I'm super glad that I ended up obviously where I did and took that random elective.
You know, that's the best one. I did not, you know, it's funny because I always liked the ancient world. I was really into ancient Egypt in like sixth grade, mm-hmm. but it's funny. Yeah. Cause I feel like, and especially, you know, it's different in different countries, but I mean, Canada, the US are kind of like similar. So I'm not mm-hmm. really saying it's different, but it's interesting. Cause yeah, I didn't know classics like existed as a major yeah. either. I knew you could do archaeology, but I always kind of knew material culture was probably not going to be my thing only because I'm really bad at science. And I was like, yeah, that seems pretty sciencey. So not a fit. So yeah, I literally stumbled right. into like one of those big freshman year classical yeah. mythology classes. And then I was like, oh, wait, I could do this and I don't have to be an right. archaeologist. Amazing.
I don't have to be an archaeologist. See, yeah, that's the thing. I could do the science. It was just the calculus that I couldn't do. And like, of course, I loved the myth classes and literature was fun. But when I realized that, you know, material culture was a thing that we could study scientifically and then I could actually go into the field, that was, yeah, that's definitely what drew me to it. Although I wasn't one of those students that ever, like, I never went to the field when I was an undergrad. I never had those opportunities. I didn't even go to Greece until I was in my master's. So yeah, I know. It was really just, I kind of did it in as long as I could. And turns out I still can, which I feel very lucky for every day.
Well, okay. So what about material culture drew you in? Was it like you saw a building or you saw an artifact and it was just like that thing that was like, this is so beautiful? Or what was this used for? Or, you know, was it like, did it hit you just like, boom?
What I remember most from my like early days of being an undergrad and like what stuck with me in that first like intro to world archaeology course, I really vividly remember our unit on like facial reconstruction. And we looked at, you know, like the Vergina tombs and the quote Philip of Macedon facial reconstruction and thinking about how we could get closer to these people from the ancient world than just what the sounds terrible for some, for I know a lot of people out there like words and words are great, but like a little bit like closer on a more like raw personal level than what the words tell us. Like we can actually look at the things people used and where they lived and where they walked, things they touched, what they looked like, and the people themselves. So like actually having that connection to people who lived thousands of years ago, I think that's really what did it for me.
I mean, it makes sense, especially starting from like a more scientific background, especially starting in something like psych, where it's so mm-hmm. much about like, you know, I'm interested in people and kind of, you know, what they did, what they thought, how they lived. And so it makes sense to me. It's an obvious connection because there's also the fact that like when you study material culture, what you see is kind of what happened, where if you study the words and the problem that philologists always find, right, is like, who's writing this narrative? You can change stuff mm-hmm. based on the perspective. And when you write something down, you don't necessarily have to put the truth. But if you study material, you know,
yeah.
you can't fudge that because you see the evidence. You just see what happens.
Yeah. It obviously comes with its own challenges because like, you know, it's not words that are telling us things, but it's, yeah, no, that's interesting. I'd never really thought about that connection to psychology. I'd always thought of these as two very, very separate things, but you're very good. You made that connection. Yeah.
Well, you know, that's what we're here for, connecting right. ancient worlds to modern communities, I guess. Ancient to modern, man. That's all.
I love it.
That's what we're about here. That's our brand.
I love it.
But yeah, that's no, amazing. It's just, it makes sense to me. So, and I find it a really fascinating, really cool connection. And that's probably, you know, it explains looking back why I had so many friends in the classics department at my alma mater who all either took classes in psych or double majored in like mm-hmm. classics and psych. And I used to think, well, that's odd. Why would they do that? But, you know, the longer I've been around people and studying and looking into both, I was like, oh, no, that tracks. That makes sense to me.
I mean, this is the thing with classics. It's everywhere, right? And this is one of the things that we use to sort of recruit new majors throughout, I mean, all universities really, but the whole thing, you know, like, oh, you're studying psychology? Welcome to classics. Like, look at all of this. Look at some of these foundational figures in psychology and see how they were influenced by ancient tragedy. Or look at philosophy, look at architecture, look at all of the, you know, politics, all of these major fields that are extremely popular. You can usually find folks in them who also love classics because it's so ingrained, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of crossover, right? Because I mean, politics, both ancient and modern. So there's a billion people who could be like, oh yeah, I'll put together a class on like ancient political thought or something. I want more like ancient psychology classes.
Oh my God.
Like, you know, we're like, the Greeks are very smart. They invented a lot of things. Half our medical dictionary is like ancient Greek words of putting ailments together. So I'm kind of like, I want an ancient psych class. And I feel like you're uniquely qualified to do that. Can you put that together?
Well, I didn't get a degree in psychology. This is the problem. Although there is a whole field of cognitive archaeology, which is exactly what you're, it's not looking at the words though, right? It's looking at trying to figure out how people thought based on what they've left behind. And it's wild. I mean, it's incredible thinking about how we can cobble together all of this theory and look at the archaeological culture and material remains and say, like, this is what we think they were thinking. This is how they operated. Yeah.
Well, there's always room for more subfields to be born, I think. Now, a lot of people would probably be like, no way, we have too many. There's so many, we can't study all of it already. So stop adding more. But I'm like, yes, add more. Add more. Yeah. People will go.
We already have to be like a jack of all trades, right? You have to be so many things.
Yeah.
In any of your disciplines, but yeah.
Well, you know, that's the funny thing, because I think within the field, right, we're already so separate in terms of, are you a Latinist or are you a Hellenist? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, why do we have to? I'm biased because I very much did not like any of the Roman stuff. So I would be like, no, Greece all the time. All the time. That does lead to not be the most well-rounded, because now when friends are like, tell me about Rome, I'm just like, I took one Roman civ course and it was like sophomore year and I promptly forgot everything I knew because I didn't like it. So I was like, yeah, I'm not super well-rounded. Yeah, I'm kind of one-dimensional.
I mean, well, that is the thing though, right? I make this joke about jack of all trades, but isn't the rest of the quote like jack of all trades, master of none? And the problem is if you do know a lot about everything, then, you know, can you actually be an expert in one thing? I mean, of course you can, but this is a challenge that those of us who teach at, you know, small liberal arts colleges like I do, we constantly face, right? Because we have our very niche research areas, as everyone does, and mine's archaeology of Southern Greece, specifically pedestrian survey, which is very, very, very specific. And I don't teach a course on that because it's almost too specific for, you know, like a small undergraduate institution, but you don't have the luxury of being able to just focus on, you know, Greek sanctuaries or Greek archaeology. It has to be a little bit of everything, but that's, you know, the ultimate problem. The more you teach, the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know. And it's very humbling, but
it's humbling.
Part of the fun, I guess.
And it's funny because I find it both terribly exciting and terribly sad. Sad as in, I'm sad because the more you know that you don't know shit about so many things, I'm like, I want to learn. And then you feel sad because you're like, I don't have time. Like, there's literally not enough time in life to learn all of the things.
I know. This is why you have to make really good friends with specialists.
Yeah.
Right?
And then they'll
and then you form a team.
Yeah.
And they can be, that's, and like your good friends and collaborators, they're like an extension of your brain.
Yes.
Which is a phenomenal way of looking at your fellow friends and colleagues and collaborators,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. I mean,
they make us better.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Oh, there it is.
I know. I'm like, I stay away from cliches. No, who am I kidding? I lean so hard into cliches and puns and all these things. So, but okay. So you've mentioned your specialty, and yes, that is very specialized. So for everyone who doesn't know, you know, anything about archaeology, can you tell us, how did you arrive at your specialization?
Oh, yeah. That's a great question. Okay. So at McMaster, at my undergrad, it was a stream called art and archaeology specifically. So even back in my undergrad, I only did 2 years of Latin in undergrad, despite being a classics major. And that was because my religious studies degree actually required 2 years of any language. I just like Latin. And I, you know what? I do like Latin and I still teach Latin. I mean, only like first and second year, because it's just would be horribly inappropriate for me to be teaching Latin literature of any kind, but I love grammar. I think kind of like science, right? It makes sense. And I like the logic of it anyway. So it was, I will say, being completely honest, hard to find a master's program in classics, because classical archaeology is firmly housed within classics, and there lies one of the major issues of our disciplinary boundaries, right? I could get into with only 2 years of Latin, truly, right? And I wasn't really eligible for anthropology programs to do more concentrated archaeology because I had a degree in classics and religious studies. So I ended up at the University of British Columbia at the program, which was then called Classical and Near Eastern Archaeology. So again, focused a lot on the material culture. And the only stipulation was that I had a particular level of Greek by the time I was done. So in my 2 years of doing a master's there, I came out of that with 2 years of Greek. But then, so I have a graduate degree at this point with only 2 years of both Greek and Latin as an undergrad. And it doesn't matter how archaeologically inclined you are. If you're working in the historical period of Greece, which I specialize in, like classical through Roman, pedestrian survey, southern Greece, if you're working in that period, it's very, very hard to get into, again, an anthropology program where you would focus on archaeological method, or alternatively, a classics program. Because, you know, you don't really fit anywhere. So I took a year off and I did third and fourth year of Greek and Latin in 1 year, just so that I could get into a PhD program. Because if you don't have that, you're not getting in, even if you don't. I mean, this is the funny thing. The area that I work in southern Greece, it's called the Mani Peninsula, and it's south of ancient and modern Sparta. And there are some things written about it. Sure. The site of Tyneron is located on the Mani Peninsula. That's the most famous site on the peninsula from antiquity, and it's quite famous, but there's not a ton written on it. And there's certainly nobody from that area who has produced anything that has survived, and there's very little epigraphy. So like the amount that I actually use Greek and Latin in my day-to-day research is negligible, minimal, like, and nothing new is coming up about the Mani Peninsula, right? Like they're not discovering new sources. Yeah. How did I get into specializing what I specialize in? Well, I was originally going to write my dissertation on altars and the growth/evolution, I guess, of sacred space around a central focal point. I was really interested in like spatial theory, space syntax, and movement in locations. I really love Greek religious space. And then I joined a project, an archaeological project called the Deros Project, located in the Mani Peninsula, centered around Alapotropa Cave, which is a Neolithic cave site. And I worked on the survey there, so the pedestrian survey, and it was the best. And that's it. Like I dug in the Athenian off for 3 years. I dug in Bulgaria. I went to Iraqi Kurdistan. My very first field school was in Vancouver on Musqueam land. But as soon as I discovered pedestrian survey, I knew there was no going back, which is wild because most people think archaeology and they love like the idea of digging and like quote unquote discovering treasure. Nope. For me, I just like an extended walk in the harsh Greek sun, getting torn up and like chased by various wild animals, running into spider webs. Like that's really what does it for me.
If you're outside of the sphere of classics, I'm sure you've never heard of pedestrian survey in your life. So I'm sure that now they have this wonderful sort of image
spider
in their
filled.
Image in their head. It's like going on a wildly off trek, off path nature walk at summer camp, right?
Yes. That is an excellent way of putting it. Yep. I mean, it's just as slow and precise as excavation, but the beauty of it is that you're not just sitting in one spot. You actually get to like traverse a massive swath of the landscape, which is part of the fun, right? You never know what you're going to discover, good and bad. Snakes and spiders and stones that'll break your ankles. But yeah, for some reason, it really works for some of us. So there you have it.
Well, you'll at least be saved from the horrible things that happen to your back when you are digging in a trench, because that
is true. This is very true. Yes. Have you been on a dig? Have you ever done that to yourself?
I have studiously avoided going on an official dig, but when I was, well, it was funny. When I was little, I grew up in Chicago, and we had the Spertus Institute for, it was like Israeli studies or archaeology or something, but they had in the museum that there was a level where it was like teaching you about early paleontology. Now, don't ask me why it's in this museum, because I don't know, but they had a random whole area where you could practice, quote unquote, your archaeological skills. And so they had fake dinosaur bones in like and it was like actually a massive sand pit. And then they gave you the little tools. You had the brush and the pail and the thing. And then they taught you, okay, so you do this, and then you kind of brush off the thing, and then you use this. And this was at the point where I was pretty young. I was in like, I want to say sixth grade. And so this is right when I was first discovering my love for ancient things. But even before, well, kind of at the same time as Egypt, but since I didn't know what about Egypt, I just liked it. I mixed that with, I really liked dinosaurs, because, you know, you go through that like paleontology phase as most.
Well, and who doesn't like dinosaurs?
Right. And so I was like, okay, I'll go dig dinosaur bones, or pretend to. So I spent a lot of time in Spertus, like, pretending to uncover dinosaur bones. Then I went to undergrad in Missouri, and they had some like local sort of they were doing some Native American heritage stuff, and I got invited because I knew the assistant curator of our like Museum of Anthropology, and she invited me one day, and she was like, yeah, do you want to come for like a day kind of fieldwork experience? And I was like, yes, perfect, because I don't want to like go somewhere.
That's exactly the level of commitment I'm looking for.
Exactly. I was like, a day, you get me for a day. And yeah, so I did. I went in a I dug up an arrowhead, which was really cool.
Hey, there you go.
I contributed. Yeah,
I mean, if you're going for one day, you definitely want to find something. Like, you can say you've done it, that now you have this cool story, and you can just brush your hands off and walk away and be like, I did it. Yeah,
exactly. So I found one arrowhead, and I was like, cool. I'm done, because my back hurts. And I've had back problems since college. So going to dig with the intense requirements for my back, I was like, not happening. Nope.
Yeah, no, it's hard work. I mean, that's the thing, right? This is like, archaeology is hard work. And paleontology, from everything that I've heard, from actual paleontologists and not Dr. Alan Grant from Jurassic Park, is that like, it's super tedious, like even more so, right? Because you're moving so, so, so slowly. I'm a mover. I like to do things, and I get a little restless.
Yeah. So I think I would actually really, really like the more pedestrian route, even though
you can come anytime.
You know what? Maybe I will. Also, any excuse to go to Greece, right? And just walk around.
Right. Right. Or this part's going to get cut out of the podcast so that all these people can't hear you committing to maybe going on a pedestrian survey.
Right. Well, you know what? It wouldn't be the worst thing if my audience thought I was going to, you know, do something really cool and different and subject myself to like a weird summer camp trek where you get terribly lost and scared and are chased by crazy things.
You won't get lost. We always know where we are. That is, at the very least, I can guarantee you that. You always know where you are. And it helps now being 2023. So like, you know, with GPS and all of the, like, you're never far from knowing exactly where you are in the earth.
Although it's funny. Wait, this goes into the whole classics and technology thing though. What happens if you're in Greece, which is not the most broadband friendly country, and you get lost and all your instruments fail? And then you're like in the mountains of Greece.
Yeah. So when I first started working in Mani, it was not that long ago. I mean, like in the grand scheme of things, it was 2012 when I started working there, and this project had already been running for a couple of years. And you know, there wasn't internet. Like we didn't have the internet at the hotel that we stayed in. And so people would, in Athens, they would buy those little internet sticks and hook them up to their computers. And we, the students who were on it, I was a student at a time, at the time, we would share, you know, an internet stick, a little sticky thing, and get, you know, maybe 10 minutes of checking our email. If we're really lucky, you could like Skype, because it was still Skype back then, you know, your friends or parents or loved ones back home. I still had like an old Nokia phone that I got in Greece that had the game Snake on it, right? But like, this was not, I know. But, and this is the thing, like my husband, when he wanted to call me, he had to actually call a Greek Nokia phone. And I remember being in the field one day and my phone goes off and I hadn't talked to him in like weeks. And I like stopped everything, dropped my backpack and like picked up the phone. And everybody's like, we're in the middle of walking. And I, you know, but they were very kind and let me talk to him for a couple of minutes, because that's how it was. And so now, even though it's, you know, just over 10 years later, it's a completely different world. I mean, at the site of Tyneron, which is my main research interest now, so the very southernmost point of the Mani Peninsula, like famously the end of the world in antiquity, right? Like the entrance to the underworld, you just stand there, you look out as far as the eye can see. There's just the Mediterranean stretching out until Libya, and you've got service on your phone. So you can just check Instagram at Tyneron if you want to. Yeah. So it's like a little bit depressing, but this is the world that we live in now. There are still some places that, of course, don't have service, but honestly, few and far between. I live in Nova Scotia, and there's way more chance of me not having service here than anywhere I've been lately in Greece, which is wild. Yeah. It's a different world we live in. I know.
No, it is crazy. So yeah, no, because in January, right? I just got back from living in Greece for almost 2 years doing my master's. And it was interesting because I would rent a car with friends and we would go, and it would be funny because we'd be driving around on their national highways, which, as you probably know, are like fantastic.
Totally.
But it was so interesting because for the most part, our GPS was fine. And then you would have like a weird interruption where for a short stretch, suddenly all your service would just drop away and you'd like be praying that your GPS does not quit on you, because you're like, no, I need to know. Where am I going? How far? But no, for the most part, it was fine. I remember thinking, because it was such a funny modern thing, that when my dad came to visit right before I graduated, I wanted to take him to remote places that he offered to take me on his dime. Mm-hmm. So I told him, okay, I want to go to the Necromantaeon in Epirus, because I hadn't been before. And so he's like, okay, sure, you're just going to take me. You know ancient things. I don't. I will rely on you. So then I got to take my dad there and explain all about it and how amazing it was, blah, 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 blah. And then we like go down this really sketchy, thin, kind of rusted ladder or steps or whatever. And I was like, oh my God, how is this here? Are we going to die? So we go down. So we're like in the Necromantaeon. So it's dark. Well, it's lit up, but either way, it's still kind of dark. And I somehow had like a full 5 bars of service down there, so I was like, as I waltz calmly into the underworld, I will have 5 bars of service. This is fantastic.
It's wild, hey? Yeah, I know. And I like, you never know where it's gonna be, and I obviously service is sketchy. And like, you can be driving through the Taygetos Mountains and go around a bend, and like, you know, it's not working because your Spotify playlist is like cutting out. And you're like, oh man, I guess this is one of those patches. But I do love that. Yeah. In the bottom, the basements of an archaeological site, somehow you have 5 bars. Although like I have big thoughts on the Necromantaeon, and it, I don't think that is what it is, but that's fine.
I know it is.
I've never been. I will go. I'm going to Greece on Friday. I will. That's one of my main stops, because I'm writing a book on Tyneron and I have to finally go to Ephora and have photos of the thing that I don't believe is the thing.
Well, even if you don't believe in it, it is a gorgeous site, because we did all area. So we did Necromantaeon of Acheron, and then we went and we sort of did theater at Dodona, which, if you haven't been,
Dodona is so nice. Yeah, Western Greece, isn't it gorgeous?
It's like another world, because when I explain the topography of Greece, people usually have an idea. And actually, I find it rather depressing that whenever you just tell someone Greece, the only thing they'll think about is islands. And I'm like, yes, that is a huge thing. It's the Greek vibe. I know you think of that beautiful sort of Santorini, whatever. I honestly think Northern Greece is like the hidden gem because I'm like, have you seen Epirus? Those mountains are crazy. You could be on Pandora. Like,
I know. I'm like you. I fell in love with Western Greece the first time I went there. And I mean, I like edges. I like frontiers. I like borderlands. I like places that are off the beaten path. So I've always said if I didn't end up working in Mani, like I'd find some way to work in Epirus because it's so wild. And it's fascinating. It's very, very cool. So I'm really excited to go back there because it's been 10 years since I've been to Western Greece. I know.
Oh my goodness. Well, I'm excited for you. And as someone who got back, I am not entitled to be jealous, but I still am because it's Greece and I miss it. So, you know, any moment I'm not in Greece, I'm like in pain.
I hear you. Yep. It's there. Those who understand that feeling really, yep. Everybody's got their place and there's something about Greece that's really special.
I know. Yeah. Everything. Tell me, peopling the past. I know you guys sprung up roughly around the same time that Ozymandias Project did. And so I would love it if you could tell my audience about your project and what you guys are doing.
Yeah. Peopling the Past is, a pandemic baby, 100%. Like that's how it all started. We went completely online and we wanted to basically create resources that folks who didn't have built-in networks of, you know, friends they could call on, experts in the field to just like zoom into their classes and provide this free labor and free lecture to places around the world. We want to provide those people without those connections the same kind of resources that well-connected people have. And so the idea was a podcast, a blog, and videos. And we have different folks working on all of those different avenues to kind of bring really underrepresented aspects of the ancient world sort of more to the forefront. And we're really grounded in the idea of responsible scholarship. And we want to feature folks who are not always as prominent in your traditional, you know, history textbooks, the scholars themselves, but also the people in antiquity as well. And so we sort of have the blog is the most, I would say, reliable in terms of schedule, because it'll start back up again in September and it goes throughout the academic year. But there are features on sort of unknown peoples. And then we have graduate students' work and their current ongoing research for their PhD dissertations. And we do themed months like for Earth Day or for Halloween. But the constant theme is to be bringing sort of things that you wouldn't hear about otherwise to the forefront. The podcast, which is what I worked on, and I will continue to work on, but I'm on sabbatical, so I'm taking a break. We've done it as seasons. So our first season was on Greek art. Our second season was on Roman art. Our third season was on sort of very broadly women in the ancient Mediterranean. And the reason we did it as themed seasons was because we wanted it to be able to accompany undergraduate classes if people wanted to use them for that. So it's sort of like 10 to 12 episodes, which really nicely complements the weeks of a semester and various topics. And again, things that you're not normally going to find in a traditional textbook and people that you're not necessarily going to find in a traditional textbook. And yeah, we highlight all kinds of fun aspects, and we try to keep it as broad as possible and reject the idea of the quote unquote ancient Mediterranean, but there's not really a better word for that. And it's a lot to say ancient Mediterranean, you know, Northern Africa, Western Asia, Northern, you know, so we go with the broadly construed and we try to be as inclusive as possible, but we're just a group of very lucky, privileged Canadian women who are trying to make scholarship more open and available and accessible to anybody who might want to check out what's going on. So that's it. That's the pitch.
That's fantastic. I mean, because that's what we love and are yearning for. And obviously this field needs more of, I mean, given the history.
Yeah, I think so. And people seem to like it. I mean, it's really interesting and difficult in a weird way being a podcast host, because if you're giving a lecture, like either in front of people or on Zoom or whatever, and there's people reacting to you, you can see their faces. And then when it's over, you can like, I don't know, hear their applause or see their like shrinking away from you because they hated it and don't want to talk to you or whatever the reaction might be, right? But you can see them and you have an idea of what people think. If you're writing something, there's a comment section if it's informal, or people respond to your scholarship more formally in the forms of other articles, chapters, books, citations, etc. With a podcast, as you know, it just goes out into the world and you have no idea what people are thinking as they're listening to it. And so it's wild. Like, you only have download metrics and then like social media to go off of. But again, as you know, social media, you're either going to get the people who absolutely love it or the people who absolutely hate you, really, is what it comes down to. And, you know, so I think people like it because people keep downloading the podcast and people keep watching the videos and reading the blogs. And when we meet folks, they tell us they like it. But it's a very interesting form of scholarship, because I do think it is. I do think all of these products that we put out are our scholarship. But it's a wild ride not knowing.
I mean, it definitely is. Like,
I don't know if you feel the same.
No, for sure, because it's like these are all mediums in different ways that tap into like specific people's neuroses about a lot of different things that you. Normally in a different environment, you can kind of control what things you would be expecting. But with something like this, if you just put it out into the world, then you're like, oh God, the neuroses are expanding and expanding.
And academics love to control things. I love to control things. So it was a weird decision. But you know what? 2020 was a weird year. We all made weird decisions. And here we are.
Well, and now we have so many things. I mean, I loved seeing how many projects popped up as pandemic babies, because you know my show was for sure. I was just bored and I was sad because I wasn't doing anything with my classics education. So I mean, you know, I suppose I didn't really need an excuse to just talk to really smart, cool people who all like the same thing as me. But you know what? I was like, might seem more legit if it's a podcast and not just me cold emailing people being like, let's have a conversation, which makes me sound really sad and lonely. I wasn't, but you know.
I mean, wouldn't it be nice if people did just have conversations? But although this way, it's great because people can listen in on your conversation in a non-creepy way. I think I just made it creepy. This way, people can hear what you're saying. No, I think it's a great thing. It's cool how many, like you say, how many projects have come out of the pandemic. And there are a lot of, you know, classics and classics adjacent podcasts and other content out there. But what I think is really neat is that they all sort of complement each other and they're all really fitting, you know, these niches and lacunae in what currently exist. And, you know, the students seem to love that, right? They want things that are not a traditional textbook. They want to hear real people talk and learn about and hear stories.
Yeah, I feel like that was kind of the biggest neurosis I had about starting my show, at least. I don't know if you felt the same, but like, I didn't really know the state of podcasting for ancient history classics, but I kind of figured, okay, well, there's going to be an angle or a lane that would complement, but not tread on someone else's toes. And then I was really happy to see that, like, with all the new shows and the things that popped up, somehow people avoided doing exactly the same thing. Like, no one's doing it. Or if you're doing something that's very similar to someone, like, completely different angle. And so, you know, I think the perception is like, well, it's ancient history. I mean, come on, how much is there? I'm like, well, actually, surprisingly a lot more than I thought, because somehow we're all doing something different with the same material. But yeah, it, you know, and you compare them together, because I was noticing the other day, like, I saw a deep dive video into like someone else's research or something, and I had interviewed that person, and yeah, we'd covered their research, but more like them and how they got their start. And I was like, oh my God, I could pair these two together. So you'd get the person and their start and then how that led into the research, and then you get the research. So it's kind of wonderful. But I am kind of curious. I think one thing that a lot of people might be wondering is, were you able to start Peopling the Past kind of like organically, where you and colleagues just decided to band together? Like, did you all know each other? Or was this institutional help helped you put together the thing?
That's a great question. I am not very active on social media as a professional. I actually like got Twitter when I worked in Hawaii because I felt so like literally isolated from the rest of the world. And you realize like the closest people who work to you are like thousands and thousands of miles away. Yeah. So I originally got Twitter for that reason. And in 2020, the people in the past started with a tweet because I had like put on Twitter, if I made podcasts for an art and archaeology course, again, that was our first season because I was teaching Greek art and archaeology. Like this is not, you know, like let's not beat around the bush here. I was creating material that I also could use, right? Very happy. Like I share my syllabus and like anybody can model it the exact same way. But oh yeah, no, it's because I was teaching that course and I was like, I got to do something here, I guess. And it was all friends of mine from various stages of mostly grad school. So People in the Past currently is, it started with me and Carolyn LaFerrier as podcast hosts, Christine Johnson doing the video production, Megan Daniels working on the blog, and she's still the blog editor, Sabrina Higgins as webmaster, and Melissa Funky was our social media person at the time. And now we have Victoria Austin, who's come on board since, who's also doing social media. Besides Vicky, the rest of us all did some form of our graduate education at the University of British Columbia. So that's how we all sort of knew each other in various ways, shapes, or forms. It was started out of the conversation on social media, on Twitter, and then we just started like we DM'd each other and we're like, do we really want to do this? Like, is this something that we actually could do? And just divided it up into different areas that folks were interested in. And we went from there. And Carolyn and I took the first season of the podcast. And then she took a step back and Melissa and I hosted the second and third seasons. Yeah. And that was it. So we were friends. We all live far away from each other now. We all teach at work at different institutions. The closest folks, there's three of them who are still in the Vancouver area, but they're all, all in different institutions. And so it was a nice way to also like come back together after so long.
No, that's lovely. And I think that also shows the thing that I guess got me kind of depressed when I finished undergrad was, you know, all my good friends who like the same things are moving far away because that's the nature of if you want to get a job or do something. So I think it's a lovely reminder that, you know, you can still be quite connected and work on cool things with colleagues and friends.
Totally.
Wherever, right?
Oh yeah. Coming up with these sorts of projects that are passion projects that really like, you know, like set a fire under you and that you're passionate about and that it's a joy to work on is made that much better when you're working on it with people that you love. And like another project that I'd started with friends during the pandemic was Raya Classical Reviews. And all of us who started that, we had all done the regular year at the American School of Classical Studies at Athens together. And we really, really believe in the project. Raya is wonderful. I, you know, support it wholeheartedly. But it was really, you know, we wanted to work together on something. Like that was the motivation to work together with people that you know and you trust and you love. It was almost equally as strong to work on something that you really care about. And finding that balance, I mean, that's huge. It's huge for whatever you're doing, whether you're co-editing a book with somebody or you're trying to start an archaeological project. Like finding your people is so important because exactly as you say, we're all so far away from each other. And a lot of us teach in these small colleges where there's, you know, nobody else does what you do. And, you know, we're kind of like traveling circus performers in a way. I like the parallel between like academia and the circus. Like you move on from town to town and you forge these super intense relationships at different stages in your life and different stages in your career. And then, you know, you have these wonderful memories, but you're not with these people for very long. So any way that you can continue to do that, I think is really special.
It's so funny because as you're mentioning this and it's all beautiful and lovely. And I'm like, you know, I kind of wish that I had that experience. But you know, at the same time, it's funny because I have the mere opposite, right? Where I found my people in the pandemic, right? Who helped me with Osmandia's project. Yeah. None of them are classicists. None of them. absolutely none of them. But they were just people that I love and wanted to work with. And they were like, well, we'll help you. You have to do all the content work, but we'll help you, you know?
Right.
And
right.
So, yeah, because I had the opposite where I wanted to work with people and I wanted to do grassroots things. But the thing was, it's like, I just... Yeah, like I didn't know enough people outside of my undergrad experience because obviously you do tend to meet more in grad school, especially in classics since the circles are smaller. But so I did initially sort of miss out on that. I remember when I made the decision that I wasn't going to, you know, go on in classics, I got very sad and I was like, oh, I'm going to miss out and making all these great connections. And so it's been the opposite where all of the great connections and I've made some really amazing academic friends through the podcast where or something that Osmandia's project was doing, right? So I've made really good friends, but I've never met them in person in my entire life. And some of them I've been working with since 2020. So I'm just like, wow.
Wow. That is incredible. I mean, it's amazing. It's kind of, I mean, it's kind of heartwarming, but also a little bit sad that, you know, that it's cool that we can live in this world where people can stay connected and, you know, in ways that we've never been able to before, but it is also sort of heart-wrenching to think that like you want to maybe see these people. Maybe you will one day.
I will, you know, and that's a thing because I think like, especially after you start working, you know, and then you figure, okay, well, if there's going to be a conference or an event or something, you know, invitations will go out or you'll just on your own be like, I'm coming, let's hang out. And so it's been nice because I have been able to meet up with several people that I've either podcasted or just become friends with through the show. But yeah, no, it's really funny. Yeah, no, there's still one person I have never met in person in my entire life, but I've been working together since 2020 and I feel like we're super close and we text all the time and I'm like, wow, I don't actually know you, but I know
you. It's going to be so surreal when you actually see how tall you each other are.
Yeah, I still have no idea how tall she is. I'm like,
exactly. That's always the weird thing, being like, am I going to be taller or shorter? We had a, like at the last AIA-SCS annual meeting in New Orleans, we had like a very informal peopling the past, like happy hour. And because I was also with Rhea at the time, we invited all the Rhea folks. And it was literally like anybody who's ever been on the show, on the podcast, on a video, written a blog, read a blog, listened to a podcast, watched a video, just have interacted with us on social media. If you want to come out for a drink, and we like bought a couple of pictures, and it was incredible how many people we just never met any of these people that we'd had these incredible conversations with. And it was so fun. And I hope that we can keep doing that because it's a whole different world to actually like see all of these folks. It's super overwhelming in a lot of ways, but you know, a lot of the best parts of life are.
I know. I mean, that sounds lovely. That sounds lovely.
You can come. You come to anything.
Oh, amazing. Well, I just have to, you know, hope that you guys are either coming to LA for something or I can go to a conference where you guys will be or something like that. So
the AIA-SCS is in San Francisco in a couple of years. So you can just come up the coast. It's never in LA. It was in San Diego once.
You know what? That is fun. I'll take California because I can get around
there you go.
Easily.
There you go.
Okay. Other places is harder. So you know what? I will come to San Francisco for
perfect.
Sure.
Perfect. That's also getting edited out, isn't it? So you're not bound to that. So pedestrian <I'm> survey, San Francisco. We're making a lot of plans.
Amazing. I need to look busy anyway. Yeah, so I'm curious. So obviously people in the past is a lot. And now we've just had this wonderful conversation about how you guys do such awesome things.
Thank you.
For anyone else who is curious, though.
Yeah.
How much do you guys deal with, like, crossovers with contemporary things? Or do you like to stay firmly rooted in just teaching materials for history? And then you kind of figure, you know, will your materials be used maybe in a more modern context, but just you wouldn't be the ones to shape that?
So, I mean, it depends on how specific or broad you want to talk about being like modern and contemporary. I mean, one of the things, again, that, you know, that I fell in love with, I think, when it came to creating this podcast, but really like interviewing folks and learning about what they were doing, was how relevant so much of what people are studying about the ancient world is to our modern world. And so like a couple of examples off the top of my head, and specifically the podcast, just because like, that's what I know best. You know, we had an episode on climate change in Iron Age Greece with Flint Dibble, and you can't talk about climate change in antiquity without talking about climate change today, right? Or, you know, there's a video on tattoos in the ancient world with Anne Austin. And this is, again, a very modern thing that people think about in terms of tattooing, but this has been going on for thousands of years. And so having these practices that are thousands of years old, or phenomena that are, you know, not new to us at all, whether it's, again, we have an episode on aging with Susan Matheson. We have an entire season on women in the ancient Mediterranean. And boy, is there anything that is going to be more of a sober realization that things haven't changed a whole lot. It's the couple episodes that we have on pregnancy and childbirth, and then, you know, girlhood and growing up in puberty. And there's a bunch of those. We have Anna Bunnell Friedan, we have Tara Mulder, and we have Lauren Caldwell, all talking about issues that are not that different today. So, I mean, all of the material is firmly rooted in the ancient past, but I think that folks will find something that really brings them into the present anytime they engage with any of our content.
Well, I ask only because I wanted to use that, to be honest, to piggyback off and into, you know, do you guys touch on reception studies? Do you leave that to other people just because there are so many other people who can do it?
Oh, reception's so cool. We have an episode on Wonder Woman and comics because, again, and that kicked off our season on women in the ancient Mediterranean. And that was with Natalie Swain. And, you know, we have toyed around with the idea of doing an entire season of the podcast on reception. And with so many folks teaching courses, and again, we always think about like teaching materials, even though our podcast blogs and videos are for anyone, they are aimed at a general audience. Like, in no way, shape or form do people need to be experts, because they're aimed at the average first year student who doesn't have a whole lot of knowledge or background in the ancient, you know, Mediterranean world. But essentially, yeah, we've toyed with the idea of doing a whole season on this that people could use for teaching, but that people would just be so interested in. The trick, I will say, tricky thing, I will say, is that when you're doing a podcast, blog, and video about real people in the ancient world, so much of reception is mythologically based, right? And so, you know, we've had people outright say, like, I love your podcast, or I love your project, and I'd love to be on it, but I don't actually work on real people in the ancient world. I work on myth, or I work on elites, or I work on royals, or I, you know what I mean? And so it's an interesting sort of balance. And not that that's to say that there isn't, of course, an intersection where reception would fit in quite nicely. And that's why it is kind of on our radar. But I think that's one of the things that is sort of held back. And there's almost no mythological content that is specifically mythological, because the whole tagline of the project is real people in the ancient Mediterranean and the real people who study them. So that is why there's also a lot more archaeological content. And most of us are archaeologists, like, four of us are archaeologists.
Hey, it makes sense. But also, yes, and I took a very long roundabout way to ask, only because one thing that I had been noticing, though, and it's true, is, you know, I do a lot of work with reception, a ton. And yeah, the thing that sort of shocked me when it was finally spoken to me, like, I sensed it, but I didn't know what to say or call it. So someone eventually just said, okay, I know what you're feeling. It's that, yes, when you talk about doing adaptations in media, especially media, right, of any kind of ancient Greek stuff, you can find definitely a few Roman things, like HBO Rome, that deals with people kind of on the ground. You get a look into sort of domestic life. On the Greek side, there's like nothing. It's all mythology. And I was like, no, that can't be right. Of course not.
The Spartans and the wars.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing, right? Like, it's mythology or men fighting.
Right. But even then, it's still just like 300.
Exactly.
And so I was kind of like, no, there has to be more. No, I did a deep dive one day and I was like, no, this is so depressing. It's literally 300 and then everything else is mythology.
Yeah. Why? So this is right. And so, like, Natalie in her podcast talks a little bit about Three, the comic by Kieran Gillen, which is an excellent, you know, this is my good recommendation, a suggestion. If you're teaching anything about ancient Sparta, and I teach a lot about ancient Sparta just because I work south of Sparta and Mani was a part of Laconia, is to bring that aspect into it, because Three is a graphic novel that is told from the perspective of Helots, so who have escaped from their like Spartan enslavers. And so it's very, very cool because it responds, you know, directly to the idea of 300 and the graphic novel tradition. But that's, you know, there's not a whole lot of things like that, unfortunately. Yeah, no, it is tricky.
Out of curiosity, though, do you have a favorite media adaptation of anything from the ancient world, ancient Greece, ancient Rome? Possibly other.
Oh, okay. So I teach in ancient Greece and Rome in film class, which is a hilarious thing to anybody who knows me, because I'm terrible at watching movies. Like, I just don't frequently watch movies, but I love this course. And it's the way that we do it is that it's an upper level seminar. And so I have very few students in the course, maybe like 10 to 15. But then when we watch the movies, it's actually a community viewing. So members of our university community, but also the broader community can come watch. And then every week a student is an expert on that and gives some background about the production itself. You know, what was the current political and cultural climate in which this movie was produced, but also what is it talking about from antiquity? And we do all kinds of things. There are a couple of movies that I insist have to be a part of the syllabus. The rest of the roster, I let the community actually vote on, right? So there's some buy-in so that folks will actually come watch the movies. But one of the movies that I insist has to be there is Sophie Deraspe's version of Antigone. And it's Antigone. It's a Canadian-Québécois film. Ooh, I think it's 2019. So it's not very old, somewhere around there. And it's incredible. It's an incredible adaptation of Antigone. And I mean, you know, in a very typical way, I have a soft spot in my heart for the story of Antigone. I really, really like it. I just recently saw a production of it around a fire here in Nova Scotia. I love something that can be so radically transformed from its ancient context, but still be so incredibly relevant because the stories are so strong. In the same way, I really loved Chirac. I loved the way that you know, took the story of Lysistrata and transformed it into the modern world. So that's sort of like my bread and butter of reception. I want a movie that speaks to the modern problems that we are facing and shows, again, this is just like coming full circle here, how we are not actually that far removed from the people in antiquity who lived so long ago.
No, I love that. I love how it's a very different but very unique take on it. Because, I mean, you know, you'll find so many people are just like, oh, yeah, I'll watch the Brad Pitt Roy. And you're like, okay, cool. Just another one.
That's, oh, my God. When I offered that course, that was number one that was like voted. And I was like, did we actually watch it?
Oh, no.
I can't remember if I did. Because, you know, I pulled rank and I did, there was only so many swords and sandals movies I could watch. I also wanted different ones from different decades. And so, you know, 300, Troy and Gladiator are all ranked 1, 2, and 3. And I was like, nah, like when I do Chirac and Antigone and, you know, pull a little bit more diversity into here. Oh, brother, where art thou? If we're going to do a 2000s movie. And some earlier fun stuff too. But yeah, like it's, you know, they have their place, but that would not be my choice.
Because there's so many other good things, materials. And honestly, totally. Books right now are all the rage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it only came out in 2020, but Natalie Haynes, A Thousand Ships, like shot to the top of my favorites. And so I'm like, no, that's my favorite. Nothing will top this in terms of reception.
Oh, there's a book by, I'm able to remember it. It's a retelling of Oedipus. My kid is super into Greek mythology, archaeology, all of this stuff right now, which is, I promise, not something that I have like forced. It's great timing because we're going to Greece and then she can just like really be in her element. Unlike me growing up, not knowing that any of this existed. And I found this super cheesy series called Mythomania. And it's written by a woman and it retells ancient myth from the perspective of Hades, which is hilarious. And I don't know if she, I've only read one of them. I only read Go for the Gold, Atalanta. But it's like a it's marginally feminist retellings. And I was like, finally, something that is not just for the dudes. Like in it, Atalanta doesn't end up getting married. She ends up winning everything. She ends up being able to pick up the golden apples, still win the race, and like have her day in the sun. And I was like, this is great. I love this. Like, as opposed to, you know, all the kids' books being just different versions of the Odyssey or the Trojan War or like the same old stories.
I don't know what kids these days are reading, but I got kids right but days. I mean I was in seventh grade when we read Percy Jackson, so I hit it right at that like perfect age, because I was like 12 and Percy was like 11 or 12, so I was like, oh yeah. Perfect. So that was definitely like our big book entrance. But you know, it's funny, there's so many good materials that are quite a bit newer that I hope will become sort of instant classics and great retellings from different perspectives. Like, I read Maya Deen's Wrath Goddess Sing last year. And
I haven't read that.
It's fantastic. It's so clever because it is a spin-off. So it takes the idea of when Achilles like lived as a woman on Scyros for a little bit.
Okay.
And so Maya Deen is a trans author who imagined a trans, like a fully trans Achilles. And so it's literally a new take on the Iliad with Achilles as a trans woman. And they go to Egypt and she puts so much research into it. And I was like, yes, this is what I want. Like a feminist amazing. Achilles. It's amazing. So
that's awesome. I'm putting it on my list. I got the book. It's Daisy Johnson and it's called Everything Under.
I need to read that.
It's haunting. I mean, so is the tale of Oedipus. Like, this is not, don't expect it to be all rosy like the ancient tale of Oedipus is, that ends happily and everyone's wonderful. No, it's a wild ride. Daisy Johnson, Everything Under. Yeah, that's a good one that I have read in terms of, that's not super mainstream, but someone got it for me as a gift because they were like, this is classics reception, here you go. And
yep. I will put it on my list because I'm always looking for more reception-y materials. And, oh, yeah, I don't care if it's, you know, an abstract take, a different take. I mean, and I don't shy away from harrowing. I mean, I just read, in the past year, I've read The Women of Troy, Silence of the Girls, like super.
Silence of the Girls is
super
so good.
Depressing, but like amazing, but also depressing.
Of course.
Yeah,
of course.
I don't shy away.
Yeah. Well, then I think you'll like it. You'll have to let me know what you think. I have one more. Sorry, one more recommendation. Just because I realized this is not reception. It's not. So let's put a disclaimer on that right there. But there's this incredible book called The Power. And one of the things that they do in this book, I can't remember the author's name. I will look it up so that I'm actually saying the name of this person. They use archaeological objects throughout the book. They are illustrated, but they are interpreted from a point of view that would exist if the power structures of our society were flipped and women were in charge instead of men. So for example, you look at two figurines, one which is like, you can look at it and see biologically male or biologically female, that these are actual objects that have been interpreted as like man in power and like kneeling maid or something like that. Like these are the names given to these actual objects. Whereas in this book, it's like high priestess and like servant boy. And like they've done it in a way that it's, you know, it really makes you think how the person in charge, when they discover something, they put these, you know, arbitrary titles on archaeological artifacts, material culture, that are often a reflection of the current world we live in, as opposed to the ancient realities, right? And this is something we constantly have to wrestle with. That's another recommendation just from the archaeological point of view that is interesting. The author. Naomi Alderman, The Power.
Well, I will put that on my list. I have such a long list. I'm never going to get through it in the next, year, but I will endeavor to try. But anyway, okay. So obviously there's a ton more that I could mention, but also we would then be here until we're like 90, so maybe not. But I'm going to move us along, and there are two questions that I kind of like to end the interview portion of the podcast with. The first is, as a student, did you go to office hours?
As an undergraduate student, I was in no way the kind of student that I want my students to be. I'm saying a lot with the words I'm not saying. I only really started going to office hours, I'm going to say, like, in my fourth year, by the time I really realized that, like, I liked this enough to be applying to graduate school. But then again, only, like, I can picture the two, maybe three offices that I ever went to as an undergrad. Like, I just, nope, I just never did. Part of me, you know, was the same as a lot of students are today. Didn't really think that office hours were for me. But also, you know, sort of wanted to figure out the answer on my own. Or maybe there were times where I just wasn't really a very good student and just like went for it anyway. So no, I didn't go to office hours nearly as much as I should, but everyone should come to office hours. I bring my dog to my office hours and it has significantly improved the visits that I get. It has increased, I should say. It is not, and maybe improved the quality for the students. Most students now come by just to see the dog, not me, but at least they come say hi.
Okay, improvement, but you know, that's you do what you must. You know, my favorite professor had a chocolate drawer, so she would be like, just come by if you want chocolate.
Whoa.
Duh.
That's amazing. So, that is amazing.
But I lived in hers.
I do usually have candy. Yeah. But I like that, a chocolate drawer. I like that for me.
Yes. Well, see, and that's the thing. It worked out for us because she was an older professor. She was like in her early 70s when I was there, and she didn't eat chocolate. Not really. I mean, she would like indulge in like one piece, right? And she'd be like, this is my indulgence for the week or something. And so it worked out really well because she just had piles of chocolate in her drawer and all the students could just come and eat it. And she would just be like, I could not be happier for you. Eat all the chocolate. I don't need any.
That's amazing. All right. I need to channel a little bit of her energy. I have like a resource shelf in my office and I put one in our sort of like our seminary room area where like granola bars and things that people can just take if they like no questions asked, just go for it. And yeah, lots of stuff like that because sometimes people just need food.
They do. Well, I mean, I guess you've sort of answered it. So this is your chance to add on to it. But I am going to ask, you know, if you were going to then elevator pitch office hours to students, basically. Students, what would you tell them?
I would say, and what I do say in my classes, is that office hours is a bad name. Not for this podcast, for what these things actually are. And if people actually want their students to come to office hours, then calling them student hours maybe would help. I don't know. I don't know if it actually would help. You know, I'm not that scary of a person. I do. If you like dogs, come by on Wednesdays. If you don't like dogs, come by the other days of the week that I have office hours. But that it's for you. It's for you to ask any question, big or small, to get to know me better, to get to know the department better, to just walk around, to come grab a granola bar, just to have an opportunity to, again, make a connection. You really have nothing to lose except for your time. But truly, that is how I phrase it, right? Like, only good can come from this. So if you find yourself wandering around the building, especially if it's winter and you don't want to go outside, then just wander up to fourth floor and I'll be there. Maybe Penny will be too.
Well, if I was there, I'd come just to, you know, get dog cuddles, but also I just like to talk. So.
Right. Well, this is it, right? Most of the time, you know, students will come if they have a very specific question or if they need help with something. But most of the time we end up just chatting and that can be great too.
Oh, that's so lovely. Well, yeah. Anyway, yeah. At the end of each podcast, I ask if each guest will do a cooled reading of Shelley's Ozymandias poem. And then as soon as you finish reading it, if you would grace us with just your quick thoughts on, you know, what you think this poem is trying to tell us as humans. We get very reflecty. You know, this is a poem that's been, this is a poem that's been cited by many, many people for a very long time is either being particularly striking or evocative or important. And I'm just curious to know if you agree.
Love it. And I will say, in complete honesty, because you told me I was going to be reading this poem, I've listened to the podcast before, but I specifically did not listen to anybody else's reading of it because I didn't want to have like ideas of how this should be read. Again, I'm also not a literature person. So I'd never read this poem before. So thank you for introducing it to me, but you can be assured, guaranteed that these thoughts are just from today and for you, because I had no thoughts about it prior to this.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor, well, those passions read which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed." And on the pedestal, these words appear: "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, in despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." So when I Googled the poem, obviously Google has its algorithms, and like popping up right away is like, what does the Ozymandias poem mean? And it like tells you all of these things that you should think about, how like power is fleeting and how, you know, you can have these ideas of greatness, but like what truly lasts. I will say, if I can give maybe like a different point of view, or one that is particularly me, because this is, you know, this is my thoughts, is as an archaeologist, is reading this and thinking about what survives from that point of view, and having to reconstruct things, and thinking about particular inscriptions and statues that come to mind that have really disparate words on them, or like words that contrast the immediate surroundings. And I immediately think of, you know, gravestones or cemetery plots from Rome particularly, or the Roman world, I should say, particularly, that say specifically, like, leave us alone and don't, you know, don't rob these plots. And yet we've got archaeology, which is in its, you know, most stripped down form, essentially treasure hunting, essentially looting, right? And there's a fine line between doing archaeology responsibly and treasure hunting. I mean, obviously now archaeologists hold themselves to a different standard than quote unquote archaeologists of the early days of archaeology, which truly was treasure hunting. But I think about that when I read this poem, and I think about, again, the people behind these words and these proclamations and the decisions that individual people make and how they want to last and be remembered. And often it's not, you know, the statues or the gold that survive, but the things that you maybe wouldn't think of, like garbage and post holes and vestiges that tell you a lot about real life and real people, but maybe aren't the ones that are most filled with, you know, glory and reputation and all of these things. So that's what that makes me think of as an archaeologist, is that you can try all you want to live forever and to achieve immortality through the things that you leave behind, but probably at the end of the day, it's going to be something that you never could have imagined that that makes people think of you.
Hey, that's as good an answer as I've gotten in 3 years of podcasting.
It's an answer. It's something.
I mean, it's great. Well, also, it is funny because I do love, you know, having the archaeologists who come on the show analyze it, just because, you know, I always get something a little different from their experience. And while I would read this mm-hmm. almost from a more philological perspective and say, you know, it's a totally. Memento mori, and it's just a nice little thing for us, right, to sort of latch onto. But at the same time, it's true, because when I do think about sort of the material side, the funniest comparison I make, right, is like, if all humans disappeared tomorrow and aliens came, mm-hmm. and so, like, everything we left is still here, but, like, we're just gone. If they came and then saw, like, giant statues of Mickey Mouse, I really think that they would be like, these people were crazy. They worshipped a giant mouse.
100%. Yep. No, you're absolutely right. There's a book called The World Without Us. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but there's a section in it that I give to my archaeology students. It's about bronze statues, like in zoos, because bronze survives. I mean, if it doesn't get melted down and reused, nothing's going to destroy that, right? Like, if it's at the bottom of the ocean, it's going to be there. If it's going to be, you know, we have the bronze charioteer from Delphi buried in a landslide, but like, those are going to survive. And so what are, you know, the future people going to think about our, like, gorilla and hippopotamus worshiping cultures here in North America, right? But they're the remnants of zoos and these bronze statues. And I love it. And that's exactly it, is thinking about how probably wrong we archaeologists get a lot of things, because we're trying to interpret all of this with so little context, right? Archaeology is a puzzle with a whole bunch of pieces missing. You don't know how many pieces are missing. You have no picture to go by, and you're just trying to fit stuff together. Yeah. There's another great book, Motel of the Mysteries, that basically shows how wrong our interpretations can be, where a motel is interpreted as a ritual site complete with a porcelain throne. So, yep, it's pretty awesome. It is pretty awesome.
All right, then.
Didn't think we were going to go there, but we did.
I love it.
We did.
I love it so much.
Got to end with some toilet humor.
I mean, you have to. And it's funny because, yeah, I'm reminded every time I talk to archaeologists that the only thing that I really retained from my sort of archaeology, intro to archaeology, anthropology course that I took at Mizzou was my favorite TA gave us the good old saying, what is it? Absence of evidence does not equal evidence of absence. And I was like, yes, it's so true. And I see it more and more every day. But yeah, so I mean, with the poem really being a stand-in, though, for all these things, and you kind of hit the nail on the head, but also, you know, as kind of just a reminder that we will die, and, you know, what does legacy and monumentality mean, and all these wonderful things that make the poem so deep. The last question I ask every single guest on the podcast is, if you consider our society today, do we currently have like a modern Ozymandias, something that we think is amazing and great and will last forever? But like, realistically, will it?
Oh God, I think, I mean, whew, yeah, that's a hard question. I think one of the main failings of our society, you know, in sort of like the global north, like this idea of like, you know, Western capitalism, all this horrible ways that we've structured the society, is that we have this very misguided way of thinking that all, any of this will last. That's kind of, I mean, so like the answer, my answer is like, yeah, we think everything's going to last when nothing really will. And maybe being an archaeologist makes you kind of like a nihilist in that way. And I don't mean to be, because I do think that there are things that are incredibly important, of course, and worth preserving and cherishing and loving and all of these important aspects of what makes us human and, you know, keeps us going. But oh God, yeah, no, I think that the way that our entire society is structured is as if this, any of this is going to last forever, as if any of this digital world is not gone in, like, the will not be gone in the blink of an eye. And everything that we store digitally is just waiting to fly away into nothingness. I think that that's probably, I mean, I'm not, lots of people have said this, lots of people before me who are, you know, smarter and more famous, you know, this is the failing of every great empire and, you know, person in power, is that they think that this somehow will last, but nothing really does it?
Yeah, that's why it's, you know, it's interesting, because I went right from classics into poli-sci, and just the number of people in the ancient, it was a beautiful transition just from ancient people being like, I'm going to build this shit and do all these things and I will be remembered, to all the modern people saying, I'm going to do this and I will be remembered. And I'm like, that was shit in the ancient world. It's probably shit now. Yep. Good luck with that.
Exactly. Because like, even our geological phenomenon don't last. So if those don't, then what do man-made monuments don't stand?
I know,
a chance,
right? Like, right? Like glaciers, man. We thought those were gonna be around, but
right,
not. So yeah, I know.
What a depressing way to end. Well, way. Thanks. No, just kidding.
I know. Well, I mean, there's a reason I asked this question, because it's supposed to leave people the sort of philosophical question that they can ponder.
Maybe it makes people live in the moment.
So more, anyway,
right? Because
I hope
that's
it does.
The way to bring this like onto a positive note is like, you know, everything is fleeting. So go out and like do something that you enjoy today.
Exactly. Go take that, walk. Go do that thing. Pet that dog or that cat.
Exactly. Have some ice cream.
Right? Well, don't go overboard. Don't be like, I'm going to die.
So I'm gonna
don't
eat all the
ice cream in my fridge.
Have some ice cream.
But like a
love
scoop
it.
or a Dove bar. Okay, we can end on a sort of happier note, which is, where can people find you if they want to see your scholarly work or your people in your past?
Sure. Okay. So, I normally do like the whole Twitter thing, which is, you know, we're moving over everything from People in the Past. Our handle is always at People in the Past, whether that's Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky. Our website is peoplingthepast.com. The podcast can be found on anywhere you get this podcast, right? So Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, etc. I'm on Twitter for now, Archaeoctopus, because I love archaeology and octopuses. Other than that, you know, the internet, Google me, and I'm there. My faculty webpage, academia, all of that stuff. Yeah. That's pretty much it.
Great. So we will link all of those things. So if people want to find you, we will make you quite findable. Yeah. So thanks for coming
on the
podcast.
Me.
It's been such a fun
this
morning.
This was awesome. Morning. It's afternoon here. We're on opposite sides of the continent. My day is over. I'm just kidding. I'm going to go have some ice cream.
Yeah. Ice cream, pet the dog, do all
that. I realize now that's why ice cream was such an outrageous suggestion, because for you, it's like 10 in the morning. And for me, it's like 3 p.m. So eat the food that you feel like eating in your part of the world at that time of day.
In your time zone. Yes, in your time zone. So, oh man. Well, I would love to collab in the future. So please come back on the podcast.
Cool. This was so fun.
Trireme Transit is now departing ancient office hours. Next stop is Present Ponderings.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.